Hi folks, Oisin here. Just a heads up, this is the second of a two-part episode about loyalism. So if you haven't heard the first episode, I'd recommend you go back and listen to that first and then come back here. Thank you, now let's get on with it. This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a bloody conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. We just left off in the last episode explaining the difference between the UVF and the UDA. Now we're going to get into two of their most bloody feuds. When it comes to Loyalist paramilitaries, it seems that they were not immune to the feuding that seemed to move through Irish paramilitaries like a fever. The Loyalists in the 70s and in the late 90s would endure the same carnage that erupted between many Republican factions. Although when observed, many of the feuds that plagued Republicans were based on splits that usually ran along the lines of serious political and ideological differences. For example, the Provisional IRA lashed out against the Dublin-based IRA because they believed that the Dublin-based IRA failed the Catholics in the north. The Provisionals wanted to take the fight to the British. Many Irish paramilitary groups seemed to clash because of ideological differences. So can the same be said for Loyalist groups? That's a question we're going to look into in this episode. The first feud that we're going to cover happened in the mid-1970s. And the second feud occurred in the year 2000, after the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. But let's begin with the feud of 1974. As we've mentioned earlier, the UVF was alarmed by the rapid growth of this working-class vigilante paramilitary, and watched the UDA closely, even going so far as to send UVF men in secret to defence meetings where UDA men would gather above pubs or at the back of town halls, and discuss this new organisation. But the UVF kept their distance. For now, the UDA was still in its infancy, and the UVF was highly active in assassinations and bombings. However, the scale and size of the UDA could not be ignored by the UVF. By its sheer size alone, the UDA could rightly demand a place at the negotiating table with representatives of Westminster. This is something that angered the UVF, as they believed that they were the real militant force, and they were the ones that Westminster should be listening to, not this perceived giant group of amateurs. The first signs of trouble between the two groups came when the UVF claimed that the UDA were unfairly taking credit for their bombings that were taking place throughout Belfast in the early 70s. When these bombings happened, the UDA would use the false group name, the UFF, and claimed that the bombs that were being detonated across the province were being detonated by them. They would call a news channel after the bombing took place and say something along the lines of, quote, "Captain Black speaking, the action that has been taken has been a successful mission by the UFF." This infuriated the UVF, as they saw it as another, lesser organisation taking credit for their bombing operations, which were not only hard to pull off but also highly dangerous. And it also should be said that carrying out bombings was something that even the most hardened loyalists were never too eager to volunteer for. So many in the UVF saw the UDA stealing credit for these attacks as a spit in the face to their men. As well as that, the UDA were also in their infancy and woefully underarmed, having only pistols and World War II shotguns at their disposal. Whereas the UVF had many former British Army members and far more skilled operatives. Yet the UDA's ability to swoop in and take credit for their actions highlights that the UVF's secrecy was a double-edged sword. It worked in their favour many times, but it also worked against them if they wanted to claim credit for these attacks. The UVF reacted to the UDA stealing their credit by publishing an article in their monthly magazine Combat after one particular bombing which took place in the Republic of Ireland, which the UDA falsely claimed was enacted by their youth wing. The UVF said that they were angered by what they called telephone terrorists, and they mocked and denounced the UDA, who they claimed pathetically spent nights sitting on the couch listening to the news, only to rush to the phone and take credit. The tone in these articles was initially light and jovial, but they soon became far more serious. In 1973, the UVF was trying to enact its first cessation of hostilities and getting its men to halt all combat operations. And during that time, they coldly told the UDA, through the magazine, that the UVF will take the harshest and most extreme measures against freedom fighters. The first blood to be spilt was on Saturday, the 18th of May, 1974. This was the fourth day of the Ulster workers' strike. The two groups, the UDA and the UVF, had been cooperating in getting pubs in loyalist areas to shut down in solidarity with the workers. Another reason that the loyalists shut down the pubs was that they received many complaints from the wives of striking workers, saying that with no work due to the strike and money being tight, they hated seeing what little money their family had spent in a pub. So in an ingenious move, instead of complaining to their husbands, the wives went over their heads and spoke to the commanders of the UDA and the UVF instead. The groups respected their wishes and shut down many social clubs and pubs in loyalist areas. On that Saturday afternoon, UVF member Joe Shaw was with three friends when they walked into a UVF pub that had defied orders and stayed open. Allegedly, there was some mild ribbing and teasing from the locals towards Joe Shaw about his UVF group had meekly closed their local pubs, the North Star, at the behest of the UDA orders. After a few pints, Shaw and his friends said their farewell and left. However, what happens next shows that the teasing must have hit a nerve, because instead of going home, they went to the North Star bar, which lay on North Queen Street, to lift the shutters up and open their pub. After what must have been several hours, a passing UDA car observed that the lights at the North Star pub were on. According to multiple sources, the UDA patrol went into the UVF bar and ordered the men to shut the pub and go home. Apparently, Joe Shaw and his fellow drinkers didn't take too kindly to be ordered home by the UDA and responded to the order by launching pint glasses at the men, forcing them to leave. The men left under a hail of glasses, but an hour later they returned in greater numbers and headed into the North Star bar. What happened next, no one can be entirely sure of, but the UDA later came out and announced after investigating that sadly there had been what they called a fracas, and the result was deeply regretted. Well, some would call it that, but others would be more than right to call it a violent brawl, and at one point in the fight, a shotgun appeared and there was a blast, and Joe Shaw, the 22-year-old UVF man, lay dead in a pool of blood. This killing would have reverberations that would be felt throughout Belfast. The death of Joe Shaw was the catalyst for a full-blown vendetta between the two groups. And now that a death had occurred, this mutual mistrust, suspicion, and outright hostility had a green light to be fully let loose upon the streets of Northern Ireland. Over the next 3 months, there were tit-for-tat shootings across Belfast, as both sides firebombed each other's pubs and houses, and the mood was very tense. David Irvine stated to Jim Cusack that he was constantly looking over his shoulder and was carrying a revolver everywhere. The violence wasn't just isolated to Belfast and occasionally spilled out into other parts of the province as well. An attempted bombing attack was carried out on Bobby McKee, a UVF commander in Antrim. The device failed to ignite, once again highlighting the UDA's inexperience when it came to explosives. On the other side, the UVF showed zero hesitation in showing off their bombing proficiency against their fellow loyalists. This was evident when the Bunch of Grapes pub, which was a UDA meeting ground, was flattened by a UVF bomb. The UVF continued with their tirade and set off smaller devices, destroying the homes of multiple UDA men. It was recorded in that summer of 1974, 20 houses across Belfast had been sprayed with machine gun fire. This violence dragged on into 1975, yet the UVF were about to take things up a notch. It must be noted that although the feud between the UDA and UVF was deadly, there would be normality and moments of cold civility. Again, like I mentioned in the earlier episode, these two people weren't on different sides of a fence or a border. They were living in the same places and drinking in the same pubs. But when things turned sour, and there were moments of deadly violence, 9 times out of 10, the scene was set in a pub. Indeed, authors Jim Cusack and Henry MacDonald have stated that whilst not wanting to sound slanderous to the Northern Irish people, and Irish culture for that matter, we cannot underestimate the role heavy drinking has played in feuding in Northern Irish paramilitaries. This has been highlighted in the website Dying for a Pint, which shows just how many murders and bombings took place in pubs across Belfast and Northern Ireland. I'll make sure to leave a link to that website in the show notes. It was on the night of the 15th of March 1975 that the young UDA man John Fulton and Stephen Goatley were drinking in the Alexander Pub on York Road, North Belfast. They were with a group of friends, and there are allegations that a few hours earlier they had engaged in a violent brawl with UVF men in another pub and came out victorious. Allegedly, Stephen Goatley was playing on a bandit gambling machine, whilst John Fulton was standing further back having a pint with several others, when three men with balaclavas on came into the pub armed with submachine guns and opened fire on the men. Goatley was killed instantly and Fulton was cut down, dying moments later. Several others he was drinking with were severely injured in the hail of gunfire. The UDA response to this was immediate anger, and they published in their reports that Fulton and Goatley had been killed because they were proud and strong men who had bested the UVF hours before in a previous fight. So the UVF men came back and killed them out of anger and shame. This view that the men were killed out of anger and shame is most certainly a cinematic view of the events. There was, however, a different take on the attack, and many experts on this topic have concluded that the UVF walked into the Alexander Bar that night as a result of the investigation into the death of one of their members, Joseph Shaw. The UVF had concluded months earlier that it was John Fulton and Stephen Goatley who were responsible for his death, and the deaths of Fulton and Goatley showed that no one can be under any illusions of how determined the UVF could be when it came to retribution. I just want to stop for a second here and try and contextualise exactly how dangerous Northern Ireland was in the year 1975. So while the UVF and UDA men were gunning each other down in pubs, the INLA and the official IRA were causing havoc and shooting at each other in broad daylight. The provisional IRA were rearming in secret. The Shankill Butchers were restlessly awaiting the release of their commander, Lenny Murphy, from prison. And just because there was a feud amongst loyalists didn't mean that they had halted their sectarian assassinations. In April of that year, the UVF bombed the Strand Bar, killing six Catholics. Northern Ireland and the streets of Belfast in 1975 was a chaotic and dangerous place. Now anyway, back to the UVF. After the killing of the two UDA men, it seems that they weren't finished and were about to perform their most gruesome and bloody act. It was April 7th, 1975, when a furniture van was making deliveries along the Shankill Road. This van was driven by Hugh McVeigh from Ballybean Estate and David Douglas of East Belfast. Both were seasoned UDA men, and on this day they were just going about their job. Nothing seemed amiss until their van was discovered the next day on the Antrim Road, with the engine off and the driver and passenger absent. More ominously, all of the furniture gear was still in the van, so this wasn't just a theft gone wrong. The UDA conducted research, as they had been deeply concerned that the men had been taken by the provisional IRA. So serious were the UDA in finding their comrades that they warned the RUC that they would murder a Catholic every day the men continued to be missing. In a strange break from tradition, the provisional IRA made the unusual step of coming out of the shadows and vehemently denying any involvement in the men's disappearance. The UDA stood down but watched the IRA closely, but they started to suspect a different group. Without any proof of their suspicions, the UDA wasted no time mourning their fallen and missing comrades. They leapt into action against the UVF, and this time their target was UVF commander Ken Gibson. Ken Gibson was no stranger to attempts on his life, and his home had been bombed over a dozen times, which led many of his counterparts to wonder why he called it a home when it was more of a trench. As well as that, his 16-year-old son had been hospitalised when he crossed the path of UDA men whilst out walking through Belfast. It was the 6th of May, and 2 months after the killing of Fulton and Goatley, when Ken Gibson was in East Belfast drinking in the London Bar. Ken finished his drink and walked outside, but shortly after he was ambushed by UDA men, who dragged him into a waiting car. However, Ken was no fool and viciously fought back, managing to get halfway out of the car, but breaking his arm in the process. He probably would have ended up overpowered and stuffed into the car to be taken away and killed, had it not been for the locals in London Bar. Upon witnessing what was happening, they charged out of the pub and rescued Ken, dragging him back inside the pub. The scene has been described as a savage melee. A UDA man was stabbed in the stomach and another shot with a revolver, yet the would-be kidnappers managed to get away from the London Bar mob. The UDA's suspicions that the UVF carried out these killings were confirmed in August of that year. They found out that a UVF man had fallen foul of UVF bosses and went to the RUC seeking safety. In exchange for his safety, he had to give the RUC information, and he admitted what the UVF had done with McVeigh and Douglas, telling them that the men were abducted at gunpoint by the UVF on the Shankill Road and then moved to a UVF stronghold, beaten up and put in a van. The RUC were then led to an area in Island Magee where they discovered the decaying corpses of Douglas and McVeigh. The men had their hands and legs bound and they had both been shot in the back of the head. In the wake of this revelation, the RUC came down hard on the UVF. Dozens of men were rounded up and after a lengthy and expensive trial, over 26 men were jailed for their connection to the brutal double murder. 8 life sentences were imposed, while the jail time between the 26 men amounted to around 700 years. The Loyalist community was stunned, not just because how damaging the sentencing had been, which many observed virtually pushed the East Antrim Brigade of the UVF into non-existence, but also how Loyalists could do such a thing to fellow Loyalists. Many Loyalists, such as Billy Mitchell and Johnny Adair, have stated that the Loyalist world is a brutal one, and an enemy is an enemy, whether they are nationalist or UDA. It was kill or be killed. One would expect that in the wake of this revelation, the UDA would launch a full-blown retaliation against the UVF, but it never came. Indeed, there were still brawls, and allegedly one or two men got killed in bar fights, but the UDA never mounted an assassination campaign against the UVF. So why not? The answer is unclear. But again, these were very complicated times, and the UDA needed to prepare in case the Provisional IRA decided to attack in the face of a ceasefire collapse. Or maybe they were too busy conducting sectarian assassinations or combat missions. Many have suspected that the UDA secretly realised that they had bitten off more than they could chew, and that the UVF was more deadly than they realised. In addition to this, the year-long feud with the UVF yielded them nothing. Many of their pubs had been destroyed and dozens of their men had been hospitalised and 5 of their men were dead. So in 1976, without anything being officially declared, the feud more or less just fizzled out. The real tragedy of this feud was that many were left scratching their heads thinking, what was this over? Nobody could find any legitimate reason that any of the problems between the UDA and UVF could not be resolved through diplomacy and dialogue. Some have criticised the Loyalists, saying this feud was simply due to the thuggish nature of Loyalism, and that they just can't help themselves. The author of this episode would say that that is usually just anti-Loyalist trope. However, it does have to be noted that the majority of these violent events took place in pubs, and we cannot ignore the inextricable link between heavy drinking and violence when it came to these paramilitaries. Another possible key reason for this feud was probably the level of decentralisation within the UDA and the vigilante street element. This meant that the UDA had a higher degree of being autonomous, which would lead to them being uncoordinated and spontaneous, such as the beating up of Joe Shaw. The author suspects that if the UDA had more micromanagement within their ranks, certain fatalities could have been avoided. Whatever the reasons for the feud of 1975 and 1976, it would appear that none of the lessons were learned and would actually repeat themselves again in the year 2000, which would leave 7 men dead and dozens with lifelong injuries. And it would also alter the social fabric of Shankill. The Loyalist feud that happened in the year 2000 focuses on 2 people, Johnny Adair and Billy Wright. The weird thing about this is that Wright was a central character to this feud, even though he'd already been dead 3 years, after being executed by the INLA. The genesis of this conflict was born out of a feud between the LVF, who were Billy Wright's loyalist volunteer force, and the UVF. Essentially, the UVF weren't happy that Billy Wright's group had broken away from them and were opposed to the peace process. The night was December 27th, 1999, when the LVF were having a toast to their fallen commander in Portadown's football club. The room was adorned with Christmas decorations and LVF flags and images of Billy Wright upon the walls. The men were in mid-toast when the doors of the club burst open and 12 UVF men with balaclavas and bomber jackets ran in carrying bats, claw hammers and tire irons. The UVF stormed into the room and according to one witness they began, quote, hammering the daylights out of everyone. Many of the attackers were hardened UVF men who had been through the chaos of the 80s and the early 90s. And after inflicting a savage attack on the members of the club, they sped off into the night in cars that were waiting outside. The LVF were angry and they wanted revenge. And the following Monday they would get it, when they would gun down UVF commander Richard Jameson outside his home in Derry Lateef, 5 miles outside of Portadown. So while this violence was going on, one person was standing on the sidelines, watching everything unfold. That person was Johnny Adair. He was the commander of the UDA's C Company, and he will get his own episode eventually. He was a central character in this feud, which was significantly different from the feuding of 1975, which was a lot more chaotic and less organised. This feud was different. It was coordinated, it was bloody, and it was personal. Johnny Adair's C Company of the UDA forged a tight bond with Billy Wright's Loyalist Volunteer Force, and both groups rejected the Good Friday Agreement. The LVF was also making a lot of money from something that Johnny Adair desperately wanted to incorporate into the UDA, drugs. Adair also had what some of his fellow UDA men felt was an admiration for Billy Wright and his LVF, going so far as to call Wright and the LVF the daddies. The UDA men felt this was embarrassing because the feeling, whilst Wright was alive, wasn't mutual. Wright had a thinly veiled contempt for Adair, with his tattoos, muscles and gold earrings, and the LVF never really returned the compliment. Another reason Adair wanted to become close to the LVF was that he despised the UVF, for reasons which seemed to span 3 generations. He felt the UVF thought that they were better than anyone and seemed to look down upon their fellow loyalists. And especially since Richard Jameson's death, who had been killed by the LVF. So with the fracas going on between the LVF and the UVF, Johnny Adair saw an opportunity. With Billy Wright gone and his second in command, the dangerous Mark Swinger Fulton in jail, there was an opportunity for him to absorb the LVF under his own wing. And then he would be far stronger and at the helm of a vast drug empire. And Adair, who many of his former UDA men have confirmed was an unrelenting narcissist, simply couldn't resist the idea. The tensions were becoming worse and worse on the Shankill Road between the UVF and the UDA's C Company. Many UDA members were also concerned at how close Adair was dragging them into the conflict with the UVF by goading them. Evidently, some still had memories of the darkest days of the 70s. Adair had his men paint Billy Wright murals in UVF areas and was also trying to recruit young UVF men. But as it stood, the violence was very minimal and things had not bubbled over. This changed on August 19th, 2000, when Adair decided to hold what he coined a Day of Loyalist Culture. This saw up to 10,000 UDA men descend on the Shankill Road in a brazen show of paramilitary strength. They were joined by drummer and flute bands, with UDA flags flying high. The UVF were somewhat disturbed by this idea, but allowed it to go ahead as long as no LVF flags were flown. The UDA promised that there wouldn't be, but only Johnny Adair and those closest to him knew what was going to happen. So the Day of Culture went ahead under brilliant sunshine and thousands of UDA members marched through the Shank Hill and people waved Union Jack flags from the curbs and cheered them and all was going well. There was even a truck covered in UDA banners, in which the infamous Michael Stone stood on top of it. Many noted that Stone looked deeply embarrassed by the whole affair. Stone is the man who opened fire and threw grenades in a graveyard, killing three people, for those who may not remember. The day had a festival air to it, with bouncy castles and light shows for the children, and everything seemed fine during the day. Some noted that something was amiss, and UDA commander Billy the Mexican McFarland said later to writer David Lister, quote, "Something wasn't right. As we were marching, we noticed this other band came from nowhere and tagged on behind. All was well until 3 p.m. when the UDA marching band reached the Rex Bar, a well-known UVF pub. As the last marching band came up the road, they were halted outside the bar. They began marching on the spot and banging their drums, when suddenly a large banner was unfurled, fluttering in the wind. It was a banner for the LVF. What happened next, one witness said, quote, "It suddenly started raining pint glasses on the band. Dozens of men ran out of the Rex Bar and an enormous brawl erupted on the street. At that moment, when the UVF men were fighting with the LVF band, UDA captains Sam McCrory and Gary Smickers came charging up the road with nearly 200 C Company UDA men shouting, 'C Company, fall in.' The UVF men ran for their lives and barricaded themselves into the Rex Bar." RUC helicopter footage would later show what was basically a small army laying siege to the bar, as the men inside barricaded the windows with chairs and tables. However, some of the UDA men produced handguns and fired shots into the bar, wounding two men and one woman. After an hour, the UDA men dispersed, but Johnny Adair was still determined for the Day of Culture to go ahead. The day then took on a bizarre and menacing tone, as Adair went around the Shankill gathering people to watch a UDA awards show and watch gunmen fire off a volley of shots, whilst he disappeared behind a van only to re-emerge in army fatigues and fire a pistol into the air. Then an hour later, he held what one journalist called an outdoor rave, complete with fireworks and himself running onto the stage to shout about the strength of the UDA and how they would take over all of the Lower Shankill. By 8 p.m, many people had left to go home, but Adair wasn't finished. At the rave, he ordered his captains to take the fight to the UVF. And that night, across the Shankill, dozens of homes of families were shot up, and the next day, over 30 families were forcibly displaced out of their homes, including the former leader of the UVF, Gusty Spence. Over the next week, due to threats and violence, over 200 families left the Shankill and nearly 600 were rendered homeless, changing the Shankill's demographics forever. However, 2 days after the infamous Day of Culture, the UVF retaliated, showing that they couldn't just be pushed around and have their families displaced. There was also an anger that loyalists were fighting each other in broad daylight and dragging people out of each other's homes, in front of their shared enemy, the Provisional IRA. Many Republicans had let it be known via certain channels in the media that they had witnessed everything and found the whole affair highly amusing. Although many within the Republican camp were worried that any change to the Loyalists' command structure could affect the Good Friday Agreement and the peace lines, so they watched this very closely. On August the 21st, the UVF struck back by killing UDA commander Jackie Coulter and his friend Robert Mahood. Both men were in a Range Rover and pulled up outside a betting shop when a hooded gunman emerged out of an entry and opened fire on the men, killing Coulter instantly. Mahood would succumb to his wounds in hospital 48 hours later. The bloodshed would continue within 1 day of this incident. Cars were torched, buses were told not to run, and guns could be heard firing across the night above the Shankill. The violence had grown so great that for the first time in 2 years, the British Army had been brought back out onto the streets, and Shankill was now a ghost town. Adair wanted revenge for his two fallen comrades, and his first target was former UVF man Billy Hutchinson. This was more of a personal target than a strategic one. Adair hated Hutchinson, because Hutchinson was all the things Adair wasn't, articulate and politically minded. Adair wanted him gone, but now during this feud, people close to Adair believed that he was going mad for power. He wanted to destroy the UVF and become the kingpin of loyalism. Owning all of Shankill became his obsession. One special branch officer who had watched Adair covertly stated that Adair thought that the Shankill was the centre of the universe and that everything revolved around it. Yet Adair found that this feud with the UVF was harming him too. He was at great risk of assassination and his movements were now very limited, but he still wanted to get his revenge and he wanted to get to Hutchinson. On the 22nd of August, as Adair was stopped at a checkpoint, armed RUC officers swooped down on Adair and took him back to prison, revoking his license of release. His license was revoked after seeing his behaviour on the day of Loyalist Culture and seeing the violence that had erupted since then. Allegedly, when Adair was grabbed out of his car, he turned to the officers and said, "I think you guys have just saved my life." With their leader away, one would be tempted to think that hostilities would cease between the two groups. But that's not true. The UDA's C Company continued their attack. As Adair was having his mugshot taken in prison, two men of C Company burst into the house of UVF man Sammy Rocket as he sat in his living room chair watching TV and shot him multiple times. This was to be the last fatality of the summer. Many quietly hoped that with Adair in jail, hostilities would abate. And for several months they did, until the night of the 28th of October, when UDA man David Greer was brutally murdered by UVF men in Tiger Bay, a suburb of Belfast. 72 hours later, Bertie Rice, who was a retired UVF member who turned politics, was working in Billy Hutchinson's office when he was shot dead by UDA men. Hours after Rice was murdered, four UVF men armed with sledgehammers broke down the front door of ex-UDA commander Tommy English as he was having a Halloween party with his family. They then executed him in front of his screaming wife and children. The very next day, UVF man Mark Quayle was shot dead outside his flat in Ratcool. He was the seventh and last victim of this feud, and after his death, a grudging peace deal was agreed by the end of that year. The UVF and C Company would have to learn to live alongside one another. So that was the end of the Loyalist feud in the year 2000. Many people who have studied Loyalism, in the media and in circles of academia, note that what makes the feud in the year 2000 stand out from other feuds is that while the feud of 75 was violent, it was more mindless and less personal. This feud was the opposite. The UDA, acting in tandem with LVF men, accused some of their rivals of being mentally ill or having learning difficulties, being drug dealers and drug addicts, and there was even one accusation of a UVF man having a sexual affair with his older sister. These absurd and baseless accusations reveal the level of venom and acrimony between the two paramilitary groups. The UVF realised that engaging in such accusations were a waste of time, and there was only one figure that they had on their sights, Johnny Adair. His desire for power and to absorb the LVF and to expand his wealth through drug dealing was immense, but at the end of all this feuding, he was left no better off than he was when he started. Other UDA brigade commanders and companies stayed aloof from this struggle, and it's unclear if that was out of apprehension of being sucked into a violent war with the UVF, or out of a serious dislike for Johnny Adair. Here's where things get a bit complicated. But it's important how we view this feud, because it symbolises how we view loyalist organisations as a whole. Many within the media have stated that this had zero political reasons and was just shaven-headed thugs fighting over drug trades, a turf war with flags and flutes. This is a lazy and convenient view. Many academics, however, have stated that while it cannot be denied that loyalists have dovetailed with criminality, this feud was more than that. It was a symbol of the struggle for recognition. Who were the true loyalists? Was it the UVF? The UDA thought that they were elitist and besotted with their own image and felt they were better than everyone. Well then, was it the UDA? They believed that the UDA represented the real Protestant. But as we know, the UVF found this idea laughable and called their counterparts milkmen with guns. The feud that raged in the year 2000 forced loyalists to ask questions that are still relevant today. Who are the true defenders? And what is it that they are defending? One of the lasting consequences of this feud was that it made it so much harder to convince the UDA and the UVF to decommission their weapons. They did still see the threat of the IRA, and for the most part, they were happy to let the Police Service of Northern Ireland deal with them. The main reason they wanted to keep their guns was for what they deemed the greatest threat of all, each other. So that's the end of the story of the feuding between the UDA and the UVF. Both found themselves different in structure, rank, goal, and history. One was more centralised, more militarist and secretive, and the other being far bigger with greater levels of decentralisation and prone to vigilantism. It can't be denied that both organisations were equally terrifying, causing violence throughout Northern Ireland equal to that of their Republican enemies. This episode has shown that the UDA and the UVF were not incapable of strategic thinking. They were very politically active, and most importantly, they could be very determined to achieve their goals. But the UVF and UDA are not different sides of the same coin. They are separate entities with different histories and a different makeup. If they mirror each other in one respect, it has been in their targeting of innocent Catholics who had nothing to do with the IRA. Many rank-and-file UDA-UVF men have concluded that their strategy of random sectarian killings was effective. As one former UDA man anonymously stated in John McGarry's book, explaining Northern Ireland, "If they killed one Protestant, we'd kill five Catholics. Eventually, we got their people to say to the IRA, yous have got to get to the table and talk." It also can't be ignored the impact that the UDA and UVF had on the Republic of Ireland, which was seen after the horrendous Dublin and Monaghan bombing. As times have changed so much, and hopefully for the better since the dark days of the events described here, there is still much at peril for Northern Ireland and at risk since the great changes of demographics and Brexit. But what of the UDA and UVF today? How do they feel about each other? As one Belfast academic told the author when asked the question, he said, quote, "Let me tell you, any day of the week we can get a former INLA commander to sit next to a UVF man and get them to talk about the past, and it's grand. But a UVF man and a UDA man in the same room? Forget it. Never chance. There would be uproar." I think that can tell us all we need to know. That's it from me. Thanks, and see you next time. I just want to say a big thanks to John for taking a week off his teaching job to focus on writing this episode. I asked him how he felt about writing it, and he had this to say.
Well, writing the episode was very, very enjoyable. It took a tremendous amount of research to do to find the right sources, but there really is some brilliant ones, such as Balaclava Street, Henry MacDonald, Joe Cusack. There really are some brilliant sources. It was really good to study as well and to write about, because I think if there was one thing that I portrayed which I really wanted to show was that the UDA and the UVF are different, as there can be a tendency to portray loyalists or people to view them as one-dimensional. There's no differences in goal, strategy, and there really is. And I think I've tried to show how determined and how dangerous they could be as well. But it was really fun to write. I enjoyed it.
Don't forget, if you want to see more of John's writing, you can do so over at his Instagram page called The Troubles Archive. This episode also marks the end of the third season of The Troubles podcast. And it's been another huge season for me. And I just want to thank you all for taking the time to listen to these episodes. I'm not going to lie, this season was quite difficult to write, as my main job has become significantly more busy, leaving me with less and less time to write episodes. I'm going to take a break for a few months, but this podcast will definitely be coming back, and with the amount of episode ideas still remaining, there will definitely be more seasons of the podcast to come. Please feel free to keep reaching out. I've been loving all your messages, and I love your episode suggestions, and you can do so over at troublespodcast@gmail.com or on any social medias, Instagram, Twitter, where I'm on them all. But I do love hearing from listeners. So what else does the future hold? John and I are also looking into launching a second podcast focusing on conflict around the world. And I'm also in the middle of a project about one particular attack during the Troubles, and if all goes well, that will get its own mini-season. So that's it, really. If you've enjoyed this podcast and listened to all the episodes, or even just a few, there's a lot, please make sure to leave me a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. That really helps this podcast to grow and get more listeners around the world. If you want to support the podcast financially, you can do so over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast or buy me a virtual coffee at buymeacoffee.com/troublespodcast. So thanks again, everyone. I'll see you next time.